I'm Frank Ogle. I am a comic book writer. I've written several books that are out now. Grief, which came out in 2017 and was nominated in 2019 for a Ringo Award for Best Collection. Last year's Dead End Kids, which was kind of a small-scale indie hit. And then this year I've got No Heroine coming out, and a little bit later in the year, Dead End Kids 2. So yeah, that's who I am, and that's what I do.
Awesome. Well, I'm really excited to talk to you today and really get into, honestly, reading your work. I want to know a lot about where these where you pull your inspirations from. And I do want to start a little bit with Grief. And just touch on it lightly. Is what was the impetus for putting together that anthology?
Money. I mean, I wish I was that was less true, but when I first started writing comics, I started by writing short stories because making comics is pretty expensive. So doing a 5 or 10 page short story is much more doable when you're first starting out than, you know, a one shot or a mini series or an ongoing or something like that. And when you don't know what you're doing, like the cost risk is just so much greater. So I started off doing short stories. And I tried like lots of different things. Like Grief is pretty cross genre. There's horror, there's sci-fi, there's crime, there's some alien stuff in there. But it's all character stories. Like I like telling stories about people going through things, and that was sort of like the genesis of everything. And that's, you know, sort of deeply rooted in my own personal history. But after I wrote like 5 or 6 of the stories that ended up becoming Grief and paid for them, I was feeling it in my bank account. I was trying to figure out like a way to sort of try and recoup some of the cost, as like unsexy as that sounds. I was like, well, these are all fairly similarly themed along the 5 stages of the grieving process. So I built out the rest of the collection to sort of fit with the tone and the theme of everything else. Got Danny Martins, who's just an incredible digital painter down in Brazil, to do a beautiful cover for it, and put the whole thing together just so I could have a book to put in people's hands and start getting my work out there and put on Kickstarter to see if I can make a little bit of that money back and roll it into new projects and stuff like that. So it was equal parts artistic endeavor and financial need, honestly.
Well, that makes sense. And it's actually kind of refreshing to hear somebody kind of like break it down like that too. So thank you for, you know, being open. One of the other things, and if you're listening to this, then you probably follow all the comic reviews on our site. And last year, our writer Nico got the chance to review all of Dead End Kids, and he fell in love with it. How was the response around Dead End Kids? I was seeing it everywhere, even outside of my own site. I saw a lot of other people picking it up, and then like I saw a lot of other people tweeting about it. So how was that? And if you want to get into a little bit about how Dead End Kids started as well.
Yeah. In a word, it was honestly terrifying, which I think is a response most people won't expect when you've got something kind of successful. But the truth is, like, I go into everything I do with like super managed expectations. So like I did Grief as a Kickstarter. I did it as like a digital only Kickstarter. And I set like a really low achievable goal, something I knew that like I could do in 30 days. And we ended up like tripling the goal or doubling the goal and getting funded in like a few hours, and like, but I've always, in spite of like any successes that I've had, I've always stayed fairly conservative with like what I think is attainable, just as a defense mechanism probably. So when I wrote Dead End Kids and it got picked up for distribution at Source Point Press, I talked with Travis McIntyre, the editor-in-chief, and I was like, listen, if we sell 1,000 copies of this, that would be a home run. Like that would be like that above and beyond. First issue alone went on to sell something like 7,000 copies. Like it just took off, which on paper is awesome. And in reality is awesome too. But when you have a book like that and you've never had one like that before, and you have these like super managed expectations, some things can start happening that like are unexpected and like can be overwhelming. Like for instance, the book came out essentially 4 weeks after it was supposed, well, 2 weeks after it was supposed to, and 4 weeks after the initial print run sold out. So there's like a lot of hype before the book came out, and like I didn't really think much of it, but when the day the book came out, I got calls from East Coast comic shops. I live in San Francisco, so I'm on Pacific time. So around 8 o'clock my time, when shops were opening on the East Coast, I was getting these calls from shop owners, like directly to my phone number, which they shouldn't have had. See me, like, if I could get them more copies, and just, you know, I have no role in like the supply and demand chain. Like that's Diamond. That's up to the publisher, the printer. Like I'm the last person who can help anyone now. And like these calls didn't stop for weeks. Like, and still, like, every once in a while, I'll get like a Facebook message or a Twitter DM or something like that from a retailer, be like, hey, you got any copies left? So like, yeah, it was, it was tough. At the same time, like, it was super exciting, and like it was really nice to connect with like other creators and retailers and fans and have like, you know, something that I was really proud of be recognized. I'm not sure I think it's as good as other people. Like, I think Nico was easily my biggest fan, and I appreciate that. But man, it's so hard to look at your own stuff with like those kind of not analytical eyes. Yeah. I mean, the book is just like Grief, they're all special to me. This one was sort of me exploring kind of childhood trauma. I had like a pretty garbage childhood. Both my parents had drug problems, and my dad overdosed and died when I was very young. I get into some of that in Grief. And like where I grew up was like it was a mostly white beach community in New Jersey, but it was very low income. You know, a lot of people living below the poverty line. And like in areas like that, things like drugs and crime, like they don't, you know, they're there and they're part of everyday life. And like that can have an effect on kids growing up. Like, and a lot of the kids I grew up with, like, were affected by the circumstances. A lot of them ended up becoming drug dealers or drug addicts. A lot of them ended up dying as a result of one or the other. And I just wanted to kind of like ask the question of, do the things that happen to and around you when you're young sort of determine or tell you who you end up having to become? So it's you know, that's kind of like the origin story, like, and that's sort of like the kind of thing that starts every one of my projects. Everything is always sort of me reflecting on something from or around my life. Like all the stories in Grief are either things that happened directly to me, sort of storyified, or things that happened to people around me or that I witnessed. And like, sort of just, I don't know, the world's pretty crazy, and I try to find some semblance of sanity by writing.
And do you think that that's why so many people resonated with Dead End Kids, kind of seeing themselves in it, or kind of picking up onto that crazy world?
I think that's definitely part of it. Like, I don't ever want to like assume anything about anyone who read it and like the reasons for enjoying it. But the people who I've had the opportunity to talk to, who, and it's quite a bit of people at this point, because the book came out close to a year ago now. Like a lot of people said that, you know, there's the nostalgia angle, which was kind of ironic because I wrote it to be sort of like an anti-nostalgia manifesto. But I see that. Like, I mean, like, it takes place in 1999, which around that time I was like just about a teenager. And I think a lot of people, you know, we've got Stranger Things and we've got that 70s show. And I think we don't really have like a coming of age story for like the pre and right post 9/11 crowd yet.
Yeah.
This is probably the closest thing that I know about. And I think those people are kind of hungry for their coming of age story. So I think that kind of helped fuel it. I also think, like, you know, objectively, if I could say this about my own stuff, like it's a pretty good story. Like, it's just, it digs into some things that we don't really talk about. And it can be compelling at times. And like I said, I'm probably the most analytical person of it. But I definitely appreciate, like, in retrospect, what I was able to pin down in the story and in the execution of the story, for sure.
Awesome. I mean, I didn't get a chance to read it initially when Nico was reading it, but I was following along with all of his reviews. I mean, because I edit them, and I was like immediately hearing the passion that came behind seeing the story unfold. And, you know, I don't want to get into spoilers or anything like that, but was there a part of Dead End Kids that was either really, I guess, really moving for you to write? It could have been the easiest part, the hardest part, you know, just what about the process of creation with that story hit you the most?
And that is a good question, actually. Like, that's one that I've never asked before. That's good. You know, like, from a different angle than I think you're asking, I think there's one side of it that really sort of affected me. As a writer and just as a person, like, I generally like to test myself and push myself, and like, you know, like when I go to the gym to work out, not that I'm a particularly fit guy, but I always try to lift a little more than I did the last time, or do a few more strides on the elliptical. And the same is true in my day job, in my marriage, like just every aspect of my life, I like to be pushing myself. Dead End Kids was my first miniseries. And back then I was sort of deciding what I wanted to do in comics. And I would like to someday write professionally and full time, you know, for Marvel, DC, other IPs. I've got a few dream ones. But like, that would be the end goal, and I know that can be a pretty taxing lifestyle, and that not everybody is built for it, and I wanted to see if I was. So I gave myself sort of a challenge when I was writing Dead End Kids to sit and write it in, I want to say I gave myself like 15 days to write the whole thing. Like just the draft, not like top to bottom, like fully polished, but just get bang out a draft. And I ended up finishing it in like 8 days, I think. And so, like, this doesn't really answer the question you asked, but I want to talk about it, so here we are. But that was a little bit enlightening in its own weird way, because it was like the first time that I was writing comics and felt extremely confident about what I was doing. And I think that there was like a weird synergy between me and the work that made me put more into the work than I would have had I not sort of pushed myself. And that kind of stuff still happens today. Like, just today, we were talking about this before we started recording, I started writing Dead End Kids 2, the scripting phase of it. And I sat and I wrote the whole script for number one in one sitting. And like, it's kind of like building a muscle up. I keep coming back to that gym metaphor. But when you start writing comics, you start with short stories, and then you get a little better. You write something a little longer, a longer short story, a one shot, you build your way up to a mini, and you get stronger, you get faster, you get better at doing it. And like, I just, sitting writing today and thinking back on that sort of stress test I did writing Dead End Kids 1, like, it just feels like it's always been falling into place and like dominoes one after the other, and like, like I have momentum, and that's pretty exciting, because I feel like a lot of creators can be down on themselves at time and not feel like that they're making any progress or that they're stalled out. And I mean, and I think that's all relative and subject to sort of point of view, but I definitely have had those days. So it's the days I don't feel like that are always a gift.
Yeah. Well, I think you answered that question very well, honestly. I like hearing stories about the writing process, because I think as readers and as members of the audience, I don't think we get to see behind that curtain enough. So thank you for that.
I agree with you 100%. And like, one of my personal mission statements as a creator is to be accessible and open about things.
Yeah.
One of the things I didn't ask you before we started recording is if I can swear. Not that I'm a sailor, but like, it comes out, and like, I try not to censor myself too much and just be when I record interviews and meet fans and stuff like that. Just because like I said, like, so many, like, I think the best way to connect with people is to literally connect with them and like, let them know who you are. Yeah. Like, I work in marketing in my day job, and like, so much of it is like personas and like, you know, these are the things that we talk about and nothing else involved. And like, running my, you know, company Twitter account is just mind numbing. So I am just very on board with just letting people know who I am. Like, this, it's just easier that way.
Now, leading into your newer projects, so I know you said you just mentioned Dead End Kids 2. Let's talk a little bit about No Heroin.
Yeah. So No Heroin is my new book. It'll be out starting in June. It's another miniseries. And it is essentially my love letter to Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That makes me so excited. I love Buffy.
Buffy was, I am 32 years old, and Buffy came on in 1997 when I was 8 years old, and I watched Buffy much too early. But it had like a deeply profound effect on me, like watching this monster show. Like, I grew up watching like I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched and like the Munsters and like other like the X-Files with my mom and stuff like that. So like I had like some exposure to stuff like this on like a campier level and then the X-Files. But like Buffy was like, it was the things I was familiar with, but like told on a different level, and it was always character first. Like, and I'll never feel like I don't want to spoil a show that happened, it was on 20 years
Oh,
ago.
if it's somebody from our podcast, I have probably spoiled it all the time because I bring up Buffy whenever I can. So feel free.
So I remember watching the season 2 finale, and just to set the stage, Angel's lost his soul like halfway through the season, and he's been a total jerk off the whole time, and he's trying to end the world, and Willow and company successfully give him his soul back at the last minute, but the Hellmouth's opening up, and the only way to shut it is with his blood, and Buffy's got she's got this really important moment where she's got to choose, duty over happiness, and she kills Angel and closes the portal and saves the day. But it's like a very Pyrrhic victory. Like, yeah, she saved the day, but at like an extreme personal cost. And like that is so just imprinted on my storytelling. Like almost every story in grief has that kind of ending. Highs and Lows is one of the stories that like has a very distinct version of that ending. Dead End Kids is a lot like that. Like, the end of the book is both a good ending and a tragic ending. No Heroine is a lot of the same, and like I just, it's like a adult version of what Stan Lee was doing with Peter Parker back in the 60s. Dr. Octopus attacks, and Spider-Man's got to stop him from robbing the bank, and he misses his date with Aunt May for her birthday, and now she's disappointed in him. Like, it's he won the day, but like at a personal cost. And I just think that that's like a more honest and intriguing way to tell stories. Like, not everything's to be tied up with a bow. And hopefully that's like what's coming across when people read my work. So No Heroine is Buffy, but if she was a recovering heroin addict. So it started with like the core concept, a young woman who fights monsters, but I really tried to twist it around and do something different with it. So this is a woman who Kayla is, she's a recovering drug addict. She's 90 days clean, but she's doesn't have the tools to do it all on her own. So she relies on other people. And like there's like a fine line between asking for help and taking advantage, and she always falls way on the other side of the line. And like so like she's fighting these monsters, she's on a suicide mission to save somebody who she depends on, but she's doing it for all the wrong reasons. Like, she's doing the Buffy thing, but because she thinks she can't do this without somebody else's help. So she's, like the title is a pun. It's a no more heroin, like as in, stay clean, but also she's not a hero. Like, and like just this, it's like the reverse of the Buffy situation. This is a person who would choose happiness over duty every single time. And I wanted to sort of see like what would happen if like I sent her down a certain path.
So would you say there's a little bit more faith in her in that way?
I never thought of it that way, but that is a fairly good comparison. Like, I'd say that she's broken in the way like faith is. Like, faith is she didn't have like a strong father figure, and that's why she gravitated towards the mayor. And like she had like a different kind of set of problems that made her the way she is. But so that's gonna be my new pitch. It's faith from Buffy, but if she was like that's I'm so glad that I finally talked to somebody who knows their Buffy, because now complete.
Yeah, I mean, because that was this is going to get off into a Buffy realm, but that was one of the most compelling pieces of Buffy is when you have the other Slayers come into the mix, mainly because faith is what happens when you don't have somebody with a great home life or a supportive parent or somebody who has had to choose for themselves because nobody ever has. And so kind of like it, I exploring that human piece, exploring the weight that choosing duty does, I think is something that is extremely commendable in storytelling, especially because it, as a reader, it reminds me that the person I'm reading about is completely relatable, because I'm sure we all have experiences where we've made that choice,
100%. Another, the other angle that I wanted to sort of tackle the story was from is sort of like in like an anti-chosen one narrative.
Ooh.
Buffy didn't have a choice. She's the Slayer. Like she can reject it all day long, but that doesn't mean she's not the Slayer.
Yeah.
And like that's a story that we've seen a bunch of times, and like I don't have any problem with it, but it was something I wasn't interested in making another carbon copy of. And over the last like year or so, I've been watching episodes of She-Ra on Netflix over my wife's shoulder, and I've just sort of been interested in like how the She-Ra show goes in a way about like tackling the Chosen One narrative in a way where the protagonist can sort of reject it, and it
Yeah.
doesn't have to be their defining feature. And like that's not really what No Heroine gets into, but it was sort of the starting point in my mind of like just this is a person who fights monsters because for the wrong reasons, not because of fear, but because she thinks she's weak and she's literally killing monsters, like and showing that she's not weak. It's just a very ironic take on
Yeah.
it.
So why did you choose to add in the addiction piece, and how did you write that? Because I know that that's a very, I don't want to say a complicated co topic, but it's a very personal topic that I think it hits a lot of people when they read that or when they see it depicted in film, TV, that kind of stuff. How did you approach dealing with addiction in the story, and what was kind of your window into that?
Well, you sort of mentioned a few of them. There's a lot of reasons I wanted to tackle it. I mentioned earlier that both of my parents growing up had problems with drugs, and my father had died of an overdose, and my mom really struggled with addiction, recovery, relapse, this the whole cycle throughout most of my formative years. So it's something that's like near and dear to my life. It's very much a part of the fabric who I am. And as I was growing up, I had three best friends, my brother Joey, my brother Harry, my cousin Tom. We were all about the same age. We grew up together. And that's the four of us are very much the inspiration for Dead End Kids. But as we got a little older into our early teenage years, my brother Joey and my cousin Tom really, fell into to some hard drugs and became addicts. And I got like a even more personal sort of front row seat to that kind of stuff, and watching them for most of the last 2 decades now, like it's just crazy to say that out loud, but like struggle with, being addicted and getting arrested, going to rehab, going to jail, getting out, struggling to stay clean because they don't have the resources, and they don't know how to, utilize the tools around them, and asking for help, and knowing the difference between asking for help and taking advantage, and like if there is one for somebody. So it's just, these are things that have affected me, like, on a personal level very much. And I liked, like, they say write what you know. So like I subscribe to that on some level, I guess. The other reason was, and this is something I don't think I've ever talked about in an interview, is but like I think, well, I've been doing cons for about 2 years now, going on three, and I've met a lot of people, and there are a lot of people out there who I've met who have said, like comics and graphic novels and like sort of subculture type stuff, not non-mainstream culture, have been the reasons they've been able to clean themselves up and stay clean, and like I don't know that that was at the forefront of my mind, but like when I was writing Grief, I wrote a book that I wish I had growing up to help me see other people dealing with stuff and getting through it, and having that be out there for people. So, since I didn't have it, I want to make sure other people have it. And like on some level, I gotta imagine like that was sort of what was happening here. Like to I think that the most important thing comics can do is reflect life, and that's how people connect with it. And that sounds kind of woo-woo, I know, but if I sell one copy of No Heroine ever, which I'm sure I'll sell more than one, but if I sell one and it's to the right person and it makes their life a little bit better, that makes it worthwhile. Like, and that's the reason like I write comics. I don't really give a crap about money. Like, I'm not going to make a lot making comics, and I know that, and that's fine. It's not why I do it. I do it because I want to be additive to the world. Like, there's so much bad stuff going on and in the world, and like if I can do just a little bit to make it a little nicer, like that's enough for me.
I think on that note too, especially because, I mean, like you've mentioned, you know, multiple times your connection with stories of addiction and seeing it, were there any, I don't know, like literary tropes that you think stories about addiction get wrong that you were actively pushing back against, or does that make sense?
I understand the question, and I've got the perfect answer, actually. No, I'm kidding. So one thing that really irks me about the representation of addiction in popular culture is that we don't really get a whole view of it.
Yeah.
Sort of where I'm sitting in my personal experience, this isn't scientific, but this is how I understand it. There are sort of three phases to addiction. There's you know, the part where you get involved with drugs and are an addict. There's, you know, the addiction phase. And then there's the rehabilitation phase where you go to jail or you go to rehab and you get clean and you get counseled. And then there's the third part that we don't see a whole lot in pop culture, and that's the recovery part. I can name you 10 movies about addiction and about, you know, rehab, but I off the top of my head, I can't name you one about the recovery part.
Yeah.
Actually, sure, one TV show. There's one called Mom that my wife watches. It's about alcoholic woman who's, anyway. So I wanted to sort of explore this less explored area of recovery, because, like, essentially it's like, to me, it's the hardest part, right?
Yeah.
So when you're an addict, you don't need structure. Like, the addiction is literally a lack of structure, and it doesn't matter if you have structure, because that's what addiction is. And then you go right from having zero structure to having 100% forced structure, whether you're in jail or rehab. Like, it is a rigid system with routine and lots of tools available to you, counselors and other people going through the same thing. And then essentially you get released out into the world, and, like, you know, maybe you have a probation officer or like, you know, scheduled visits with a therapist, but you generally have no structure other than what you can impose upon yourself. Like, you literally get thrown out to the world naked. And that's something that I've watched with my brother and my cousin over and over again. Like, they do really well in jail and rehab, as bad as it sounds. Like, they're clean for 6 months, a year, and then they get out and, like, they're able to maintain it for a while, but, like, it's like the structure starts to erode without the daily regimen, and they deal with problems that they wouldn't have on the outside, like finding a job when you're, you know, a felon, or you know, having to, like, exile all of your old friends because they still are drug addicts, and just, like, it chips away at you in ways, like, that I think most people don't understand.
Yeah.
So I wanted to sort of explore the relationship between somebody who's in recovery and like the world around them. And so Kayla is, she's when the story starts, she's on the eve of her 90th day sober, which is, like, a big milestone in recovery. It's 3 months. And her friend Sid, who is kind of her rock, he's, you know, a recovering addict too. He's further along. He's got structure in his life. He's found a way to make it work. And she relies on him for an imposed structure to keep her straight. And he gets kidnapped or goes missing. She doesn't know him. She's trying to find him. And that sets her sort of up against this gang of drug dealing vampires. But she's not, like, she doesn't want to save him because it's the right thing to do. She wants to save him because she thinks she can't get by to the next morning without his help.
Yeah.
So, like, she's doing the right thing for all the wrong reasons. So the first issue is about her sort of recognizing that crappiness about herself.
Yeah. That's amazing. I'm really excited to read this, honestly. I'm actually kind of speechless with that answer. That was a really good answer. And as you're talking, I'm kind of thinking about all the times I've seen addiction and it's in different forms shown. You're right. I really can't think of too many, I mean, especially off the top of my head, and I haven't seen Mom that really tackle that recovery piece in detail. So,
yeah.
When can people look out for No Heroin and Dead End Kids 2?
No Heroin will be out over the summer. So we're talking now in the beginning of February. So we're a little ahead of the pre-order window, but it'll be up in previews and Diamond and comic shops in April and May. And then the first issue will come out in June. And it's 3-issue mini like Dead End Kids 1 was. I try to keep my series on the smaller side. A lot of people still don't know who I am, and like comics aren't exactly cheap to buy. So like I try to keep them affordable. So like, if, I'd rather ask somebody for $12 than, 15 or 16 or 20. At least until they can trust me that like they're going to get their money's worth in the long run. But that'll be out in June, July, and August. Just this morning I got the final pages for number two, so we're ahead of schedule. And then Dead End Kids 2 is going to be out. I think it's official now. November, December, January, and February. That one's going to be 4 issues. I was plotting out the fourth issue today, and it's massive. Like it had way more story than I could fit in the standard size comic. So I'm pretty excited to tackle that one. I feel like since I went to 4 issues, I wanted to make sure people still got their money's worth. And that one, I'm pretty excited for that too. Like it's going to be a huge departure from Dead End Kids 1. It's going to be set in 2008, so a little bit further down the line. And it's got a new set of kids, sort of took a True Detective approach to it, sort of same name, same general vibe, but a new story. And this story deals with three kids who are all the children or relatives of people who were like deeply affected by 9/11. Yeah, which is another thing that I sort of pulled from my own life. I grew up in New Jersey, directly across the bay from Manhattan. So, like, on 9/11, I was literally watching the Twin Towers burn down across the water. And I just, it's been almost 20 years, and I still think about that thing every single day. So, like, I wanted to sort of explore the sort of childhood trauma aspect of that, in this new volume. But it's also a heist book. Like, it's still going to be kids doing crime or kids dealing with crime, kind of in the vein of the first volume.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited for everything you're going to do this year. And if you're listening, why don't you tell everybody who's listening right now, how they can keep up with you, where they can look for your work, that's already out?
Pretty much every book I've ever made is like at present sold out. Like it's just
That's a
the
good thing to say, or that's a good thing to be able to say.
it's like it's it sounds awesome. It's like a uniquely unfortunate set of circumstances because it's making like going to cons really hard. But if you are interested in checking out Dead End Kids or Grief, like I have a personal stash of books that I, meal out as people want them. And I ran a sale back in like December for Christmas and the holidays where everything was sort of like discounted and like I'm so lazy, I still haven't taken the sale down. So I'm still getting like a random order like once a week. So if you want to check out Dead End Kids or Grief, I'm probably not going to change that sale anytime soon. I've got like reader copies of Dead End Kids issues. I've got the Trade of Grief. If you want to keep up with me on a more day-to-day basis, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter. Both my handles there are the same. It's just at Frank Gogol, one word, FrankGogol. I'm on Facebook, but I don't have like a fan page or anything like that. What I generally say is if you're not crazy, and you want to connect, talk shop. If you're an aspiring writer, creator, and you want to ask questions, like just shoot me a friend request. Like I won't turn anyone away for any reason other than craziness. On every one of those social media, there's a link to a newsletter I do called Caption Boxes that comes out every 2 weeks. If we stay on schedule, it's every 2 weeks. I usually miss a week here or there just because of cons or writing. But generally, it's every 2 weeks. And it's just kind of like a funnel for all the things to talk about on social media. I talk about the work. I talk about like what goes into the work, the cons I'll be at, things that I'm reading right now that maybe aren't on everyone's radar. I read a lot of indie stuff. So like a lot of people like the sort of recommendations there. And honestly, the newsletter is the best way because it's just like it's all the news and information in one spot. And it's an email, so you can respond to it. Like if you have questions or you want to like, I don't know, talk, I guess. So I definitely highly recommend the newsletter, and then any of the other ones are fine too. Like I said earlier, I try to keep it real and just be there for people to connect with in a way that I wish other creators who are ahead of me and who I admire were when I was trying to, do the fan thing.